collector, member of the society, and with an encyclopedic knowledge of many of these South American. And the opportunity of asking Brian to show one of his collections was one really good, too good to miss. Not a subject I knew much about, but I hope to know a lot more later. Brian, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you for braving the weather. We had to dig out the snow this morning, but we got here. Chaco Wall. People don't know a lot about it, so I hope you've had time to have a look through the material on display and to peruse the booklet I've made for you. What I've done in the booklet, I've tried to cover as much as possible the philately of the Chaco Wall. So it tells you a little bit about how the postal systems worked and things like that. The material on display probably represents about a quarter of what I've got in Chaco material. I will stress this is the prettiest quarter. A lot of wall covers leave a lot to be desired condition-wise. It's still an active collection. Things are still being added to it. And we're also working with two or three other collections in the world of the Chaco. We are working together, the small group of Chaco collectors, in, you know, trying to enhance the knowledge, and hopefully one day we'll make the book. We'll see. Now, rather than try sort of walk you through the collection, trying to tell you the differences between different center markings and things like that, I thought in this instance it might be much better to actually try tell you something about the history of the countries involved and the history of the war itself and its outcome. The war was fought, the Chaco War was fought between Bolivia and Paraguay and lasted from June 1932 to June 1935. In fact, it started on the 15th of June and ended on the 14th of June, so it was an exact 3-year period. Now, what is the Chaco? The Chaco is an area of about 300,000 square kilometres. To put that into perspective, it's sort of 600 miles long and about 250 miles wide. It's got the Paraguay River on the east side, it's got the Pilcomayo River on the southwest, the lower plateau of the Andes on the west, and the Bolivian plateau at the north. It's not a nice place. Imagine a desert in the summer, the worst attributes. It's got that. Imagine a jungle in the wet season. It's got that. The main vegetation is a spiny thorny bush that grows about 3 meters high. And there are vast areas of this, you know, endless to the horizon. It's interspersed with a thorny grass, which grows in meadows in soft sandy soil. So it's difficult to walk on because of the soft ground. And obviously when it's the wet season, it's becomes a quagmire, very, very difficult to get around. At the time of the war, it was populated by a few primitive Indians, Paraguayan Indians, some Mennonites, and the areas near to the Paraguay River, were farmed. They grew yerba mate and some other crops and did some grazing there. Now, apart from the local, you know, the few people that lived there, there was a small, wonderful array of local wildlife. You could get poisonous snakes, poisonous spiders, huge columns of large black ants that would eat anything, and wonderful clouds of aggressive flies and mosquitoes. I'm told they pick you up and take you away for dinner. So it's perhaps not the best place for your holiday. Now, who owned the Chaco? Well, both countries claimed it. Bolivia claimed it on the basis of their old maps from the Spanish period. And Paraguay claimed it basically because it occupied some of the area. They've argued over it ever since independence. And in 1897, President Hayes of the USA arbitrated between the two countries. And he actually drew a nice neat line from the southwest corner to the northeast corner and said that's it. So they got half each. That effective demarcation line stood in good stead for almost 3 decades. Now, why would anyone want to fight over this land? Basically, it was oil. Standard Oil in Bolivia, bless you, Standard Oil in Bolivia had discovered oil in the Tarija region, which is the lower Andes. And Bolivia is a landlocked country, so in order to benefit economically from its oil, it needed to export it. And it would have been advantageous for Bolivia to have a foothold on the Paraguay River, which is navigable for quite large ocean-going vessels almost. You can get pretty big ships up there. Then it can export its oil to the overseas markets. This was one of the reasons. The other reason was if there's oil in the lower Tarija region, at the top edge of the Chaco, what's under the Chaco? More oil? Question mark. So this led to the military build-up on the Bolivian side. Now let me give you a little background on Bolivia itself. Bolivia was originally known as Alto Peru, which is Upper Peru, and was part of the Spanish Viceroyalty of Peru. It came to prominence in 1544 when they found rich silver deposits in the Andes. And these started to be mined around this date, and the first Spanish settlement in Bolivia was Potosi. Interestingly, it became the largest population center on the South American continent and actually stayed that way for the next 200 years, so Potosi was a big city. Bolivia proclaimed its independence from Spain in 1809, but it wasn't until 6th of August 1825 that a republic was finally formed. Two fairly well-known characters played a hand in this. One was General Sucre, the Colombian, and the other was Simon Bolivar, the Venezuelan. Both actually served short terms as presidents of Bolivia. And in 1826, Bolivia was formally named Bolivia in honor of Simon Bolivar. Bolivia's territory originally extended down to the Pacific coast and included the port of Antofagasta and most of the coastal regions of the Atacama Desert. Again, border tensions, this time with Chile. The reason for the border tensions were rich nitrate deposits on this coastal region. Bolivia ended up joining with Peru and declaring war on Chile to try and make sure they had this area. That was called the War of the Pacific. That lasted 4.5 years, from 1879 to 1883, and it was won by Chile. Bolivia lost its Pacific coastline in that war and became a landlocked country. Bolivia didn't have too much success in wars. In 1903, it lost the state of Acre in the Amazon Basin to Brazil, and that was due to their attempts to tax rubber. That was in 1899. It was an attempted declaration of independence for Acre, and it finally seceded to Brazil in 1903. But that's another story, anyway. On to Paraguay, some background on Paraguay. Now, the first European to visit Paraguay was apparently the Portuguese explorer Alexio Garcia. This was in 1524. Now, they call these guys explorers, but they're a bit like Indiana Jones. They were after one thing, and that was gold and silver. Anyway, he started out from the Brazilian coast and traveled to the interior. He was the first person to actually cross the Chaco and to reach the Inca Empire from the eastern side. He led several raids on the Incas and was reasonably successful in plundering some silver, but the legend of the time was there was this white king over there and he had mountains of gold. These were never been found, but anyway, Garcia got his silver, fairly large hoard, and then was repulsed back, so he headed off back to the Brazilian coast. Alas, he never made it. He was murdered by Indians on the way, and as was customary at the time, doubtless ended up on their dinner table. Nevertheless, rumors of this hoard of Inca silver treasure filtered back to Europe, and several other attempts were made to actually get across to Paraguay and this eastern Andes region. The next successful attempt was actually by a Spaniard, a guy called Sebastian Cabot. And he decided to look for a route by exploring the Paraná and Paraguay river system. When he was in the interior, he sighted many Indians with silver objects. And these were probably from the Garcia raids. And it was he who named the river system Rio de la Plata, or River of Silver, which today we know as the River Plate. Now, the first successful Spanish settlement on the eastern side of South America was actually at Asunción in Paraguay. Now, that's Asunción, just to let you know, is 1,000 miles up the river system. It's a long way from the coast. But the Spanish soon realized that Paraguay was no actual El Dorado. There was no minerals there, nothing to mine, nothing of any great value. And as they said at the time, the Chaco stood between them and the Andes, and the Chaco was described at the time as a harsh wilderness of searing heat, floods and storms. So the main Spanish focus at that time was in Peru, and the easiest way to get to Peru was via Panama. On the east coast, Buenos Aires was successfully established, and Paraguay slowly became a backwater. Now, Paraguay declared its independence from Spain and from Buenos Aires on the 17th of May 1811. Buenos Aires had looked upon Paraguay as one of its provinces. The first real Paraguayan leader was a guy with a wonderful name of José Gaspar Rodríguez de Francia. And he more or less ran the country successfully as a fairly ruthless dictator until his death in 1840. Coups and chaos followed until Carlos Antonio López was named president in 1844. Now, Paraguay did well under López. He put in infrastructure, schools, and, you know, actually did the country some good. He died in 1862, and his son, Francisco Solano López, took over. This was the crazy López. He's best known for the War of Triple Alliance. In 1864, he declared war on Brazil. Paraguay, Brazil. He managed to antagonize the Argentines. Paraguay, Brazil, Argentina, and the Uruguayans. They formed something called the Triple Alliance and invaded Paraguay in 1866. The result was inevitable, but I mean, you've got to give it to López, because 1866 they invaded, he didn't get killed until 1870. Alas, the whole male population of Paraguay went with him, around 200,000 men. The population of Paraguay at the time was around 450,000. Just for interest, at the time of the war, Brazil's National Guard, this is the National Guard in Rio, was also about 450,000. So you can see the odds were against the Paraguayans. Anyway, as I say, López died in 1870. Now, interestingly, he's still officially classed as one of Paraguay's greatest heroes. This is undoubtedly because of the chutzpah of actually doing what he did. But anyway. Now, coincidentally, Paraguay issued its first stamps in 1870. And one of the reasons they're so scarce on cover, in fact, there was nobody left in the country to write anything. Anyway, the result to Paraguay was they lost territory to both Brazil and Argentina. The famous Iguazu Falls, many of you may have heard of, used to be in Paraguay, and now they're on the border between Argentina and Brazil. Anyway, to jump a little bit, 1920s, unrest and civil war in Paraguay. They had a president called Guggiari until 1928, and then he was replaced in office, in 1928, and then he was replaced in office by Eusebio Ayala in 1932. He was there during the Chaco War period. Now, in hindsight, war with Bolivia was probably inevitable. Because of the unrest in Paraguay during the 1920s, and because of the discovery of oil and the Bolivians eyeing the Paraguay River, Bolivians started to encroach and build what they call fortins, which are just basically fortified encampments in the Chaco area. In 1928, a young Paraguayan major, a guy called Rafael Franco, finally took exception to these Bolivian actions and took it upon himself to actually attack and burn down one of these Bolivian forts. This was Fort in Vanguardia in the northeast corner of the Chaco. He became an overnight national hero, but alas, the president, Guggiari, felt that Paraguay was unprepared for war and offered to maintain the peace by rebuilding the fort for the Bolivians. Franco was dismissed from the army and went into exile. and war finally broke out in 1932. Now, how did the war start? It's an interesting story of insubordination. If it happened in any Western country, the guy would have probably been faced a firing squad. But anyway, a Bolivian pilot, Major Oscar Moscoso, was flying over the central Chaco region. And if any of you managed to look at the map I left on the back, there's one little dot of blue in the middle of the Chaco, and that's a lake, Lake Pituantuta. And it's the only source of water in the central Chaco. He spotted this lake on a reconnaissance mission, and this was in April 1932. And obviously it's of strategic importance, it's the only water in the area. He noted its size, location, and the fact that it was a small Paraguayan fort on the eastern edge of the lake. By the time this report reached the Bolivian president, Salamanca, and the high command in La Paz, the mention of the Paraguayan presence on the lake had mysteriously disappeared. So the president ordered Moscoso to go take possession of this lake. Don't forget, he was flying over it, and then he had to go on land to find it, so it wasn't quite as easy an order as it sounded. He eventually found the lake about a couple of months later, and with a group of soldiers, and they took over the lake. This was on the morning of the 15th of June, so they fired shots in the air, and the Paraguayans ran, and the Bolivians took over, and that was the first shots of the Chaco War. Now, when La Paz heard that Paraguayans had been present at the lake, the order was given to vacate the Paraguayan fortin they'd overrun and set up a Bolivian one on the western side of the lake. That's the side nearest to Bolivia. Now, this order was intercepted and not passed on to Moscoso. Eventually, of course, the Paraguayans, having run away, then regrouped and mounted a counterattack. And then they took the fortin back off the Bolivians. So by the time this has got back to La Paz, La Paz see this as an attack on the fortin they'd ordered built on the west side of the lake, and a totally unprovoked attack or a major aggression over a minor original incident in which nobody had lost any life. The Bolivians then retaliated on that by seizing one of the major Paraguayan strongholds at Bocaron, along with some other fortins. And that's what started the war in earnest. Now, who was responsible for this? And this points to a guy called Lieutenant Colonel Enrique Peñarada, through whom both the original report and the resultant orders were ferried or channeled. He was an ambitious guy and realized that the war would give him opportunities for promotion and advancement. And true enough, he went on to become commander of the Bolivian army, and later in the post-war period, actually was president for a while. So the war was started by a single individual as a way to promote his political ambitions. Now, interestingly, being president of Bolivia isn't really a good career move, in case any of you. It doesn't have good job security. In recent times, Bolivia had an entry in the Guinness Book of Records: 175 coups in 175 years. However, our hero here, Mr. Peñaranda, managed to stay in power for around 3.5 years before he was ousted in a coup. So he didn't do too badly. Now, what was the state of the opposing sides at the start of the war? Obviously, Bolivia were the antagonists, and therefore they were much better prepared for the hostilities. In 1930, it had used proceeds from its mining industries, along with a line of credit from Standard Oil, to buy a major arms shipment from Vickers Armstrong in England. These included tanks, machine guns, carriers, scout planes, anti-aircraft guns, and all sorts of small arms and other good things. They had an air force of around 60 planes in total for both combat and reconnaissance. On the ground, they had around 100,000 troops on the ground. At the outbreak of the war, Bolivia's population was around 3 million people. On the Paraguayan side, it was a different story. They had 5 or 6 obsolete Fiat biplanes. One was usually in the process of being cannibalized, which is why it's 5 or 6. They had an ill-equipped ground force of about 5,000 troops only. Troops were known as the bare feet. They didn't have boots. Their weaponry consisted of knives and machetes. They had one rifle between 3 people. The only advantage they had was the Paraguay River, and they had two gunboats. Somewhere on the back of one of these sheets is a picture of one of these gunboats, and you don't want to see it. But they had two gunboats, the Fumaita and the Paraguay, that operated on the Paraguay River. And at the time of the outbreak of the war, Paraguay's population was around 1 million. So the odds were a bit against the Paraguayans. Now, on to the actual war. The Bolivians advanced quickly, and as I said earlier, they took Boqueron, which was one of the major Paraguayan strongholds, in July 32. Now, the Paraguayan military commander, a guy called José Félix Estigarribia, was given explicit instructions, though not in writing, by the president to retake Boqueron at all costs. So he put all his effort into retaking Boqueron. Now, he was quite a decent strategist, so he managed to cut off the supply lines and surround the place. And it took him a couple of months, but basically he starved them out. Bolivians finally surrendered. Their food and water supplies were almost non-existent, gone, and they'd been reduced to stripping ammunition off dead people in no man's zone. In other words, have bullets to fight with the next day. Now, the defeat at Boqueron was a huge blow to Bolivian morale, and this led to the Bolivian president at the time, Salamanca, replacing his commander of the army at the time, was General Osorio, with another general called General Hans Kunt as commander of the army. Now, Kunt had been a World War I veteran. He was a German, and he'd held the rank of brigade commander in the German army. He was grateful for organizing things, getting supply lines going and things like that, but he had very little imagination for strategies. And 9 times out of 10, he committed his troops into head-on attacks. He had superiority of numbers, so that was the way to go as far as he was concerned. Obviously, that had disastrous consequences on many occasions. On the Paraguayan side, Estigarribia, as I said, was much more of a strategist, and rather than get involved in head-on clashes, he would exploit the long supply lines and move in and cut these, and then do the siege bit again. And at least that did part of his job for him. Got to bear in mind, throughout much of the conflict, from Bolivia to the front lines was a journey of around about a month. So your regular Bolivian soldier to get from the main cities in Bolivia to the front lines had a pretty horrendous journey to get there. Water, food, fuel, ammunition, all had to take this long journey, around about a month. Paraguay, on the other hand, with the river system and the railhead, could get access to the front line within a couple of days. So it was being fought in Paraguay's backyard, and this was one of the major factors that helped determine the outcome of the war. Another was the fact that Paraguayans were much more nationalistic about this. I mean, men queued up to enlist in their thousands, despite the no boots. And there was a major pride in defending their country. Many of the Bolivian troops, on the other hand, were conscripts from the high Andes region. They were kitted out in these beautiful woolen uniforms, which at 10,000 foot altitude were great, but at 110 degrees in the desert, you don't want to wear them. So, you know, the Paraguayans were a lot more nationalistic, and they really had something to fight over, because the Bolivians were really in their backyard. And the third factor was the one that during the course of the conflict, Bolivia had the one president and the one commander of the army. On the Bolivian side, they got through two presidents, Salamanca and Suzano. Salamanca went after one of the Bolivian defeats, and three commanders of the army. Osorio, I mentioned, Kunt took over, and then our guy, Peñaranda, who started the whole thing, finally got his turn as commander of the army. There were many reversals of fortune. It was a nasty war. And, you know, throughout the 3-year period of the war, Paraguay prevailed, and eventually the Bolivians were pushed totally out of the Chaco region, and Paraguay, in fact, went into some Brazilian territory. And the permanent ceasefire came into effect on the 14th of June, 1935. However, the final peace treaty wasn't signed until 3 years later, on the 21st of July, 1938. Now, the final peace treaty recognized most of Paraguay's claims to the Chaco. Bolivia did get a narrow corridor to the river and a virtually useless swampy port up on the far reaches of the Paraguay River. She was allowed railroad and port privileges in Paraguay, but these had been available anyway in the pre-war period. The oil? That's the final irony. The supposed petroleum wealth that had been a major cause of the war turned out to be non-existent. There was no oil in the Chaco. Bolivia's own modest output didn't end up going down the river on barges. It went by pipeline through Brazil. The oil speculators of the day pronounced, we made a mistake, sorry about that. And they left the Chaco to its few inhabitants and the many dead. It was a totally pointless war between two of South America's poorest nations. Bolivia lost over 52,000 men and a further 72,000 wounded or maimed. Paraguay lost over 36,000 men with a further 49,000 wounded or maimed. If you look at those casualty figures in Paraguay's case, that's nearly 10% of the population. In a nice little square in Asunción, overlooking the river, there's a monument to the Chaco War. It's a captured Bolivian tank, manufactured by Vickers Armstrong in England and financed by Standard Oil in America. The plaque on the monument reads, "In tribute to the gallantry and heroism of two kindred people, peoples who, through human error and injustice, took up arms against one another." Now, how did I get involved in the Chaco War? I first got involved with Chaco War exactly 25 years ago, and it was thanks to Tony Shepherd, who I believe was a member of the Royal at one time, but I don't think he is anymore. He authored two little booklets on the postal history of the war, and he offered me his collection intact. He was having difficulty expanding it, and he finally gave up the chase. I bought it. The only other Chaco material I knew of at the time was with another deceased member, a guy called Tony Lovibond, who some of you may remember. I said to Tony, "Can I buy your Chaco material, the Paraguay bit?" He said, "No." So I said, "Why not?" But anyway, I persuaded him a little bit, and he said, "Well, you find me an Ecuador 1872 1 peso on cover, and we'll do a swap." It's a bit like asking for the moon. The Ecuador 1 peso was a 16 times letter rate in 1872. So there you go. So I had a word with Derek Bolton, and some of you may know, London Stamp Exchange, and said, "Derek, do you have a 1872 Paraguay, Ecuador peso cover?" He said, "I think I might have." So next Grand Palace Stamp Show, he turned up with one. Big long legal cover, little peso on the corner. So I called Tony up and said, "I've got your peso cover." He was stumped. He wasn't expecting that. But true to his word, we did an exchange, so that was good. I got some of the more attractive military items from the daughter of a guy called Ludwig Horn, who had been a stamp dealer in Bolivia during the conflict. And the only other collector I knew of at the time, this is sort of in the 80s, was a guy called Herwin Herskovich from Pennsylvania. He had a fairly important Bolivia collection, you know, with first issues and everything else, but he also exhibited a Chaco War collection. He showed it in Toronto in 1987, got a large Vermeer, I seem to recall. We corresponded, and I'd also visited with him in the US on one occasion. Sadly, he passed away in the late 1980s, but I was surprised and delighted to hear from his executor. He'd left instructions that I'd be offered his Chaco collection, so that was another major section of material that I got. Most of the time things come in ones and twos. You can find odd covers here and there in boxes. The only other big group was part of the Pedro Weiss collection of Paraguay, which came up in one of the Feldman sales. The Herskovich collection was important to me because one of the major pieces he had was the Platineos provisional. That's the first, third frame, second row down, first cover. It's an airmail stamp, and it's really the only stamp issue of the war that was specifically made because of the war. Mail for Bolivian troops was free. You can send your letter home, but I've just described it takes a month to get up there. You could expedite this by airmail by paying a 30-cent fee. And Platineos, which is where this provisional was made, had a small field post office, and they ran out of 30-cent stamps. They had apparently 10 sheets of 5-cent stamps left, and so the local postmaster or guy in charge decided to surcharge these 30 cents, because 5 cents a time, 6 stamps to every letter, they're going to run out fairly quickly. So he made these provisionals, and supposedly anecdotal, but about 1,000 copies were made. The reason they're not around is most were lost in the conflict. They were damaged, burned in one of the many fights that happened around Platineos. I did get a second Platineos cover a few years ago, and that came out of Bolivia. It is interesting, the same center marks are on the back of both of them, so they both did originate in the same place. Now, I don't want to reiterate what I've written in the booklet, but the Platineos provisional is an important stamp, and probably the most important stamp in the conflict. To put it into context now, I have seen probably a dozen copies of the stamp altogether. There's 7 in the frames here, and if I had to guess, I'd say there's about 20 or 25 copies might exist. To put that into context, it's 4 to 5 times rarer than an inverted Jenny, 1924. Having said that, if somebody wants a copy desperately and they've got an inverted Jenny, they can talk to me. Is that all right? On the philatelic front, both countries had indulged in a little pre-war and wartime propaganda by issuing map stamps with the Chaco region on. I put a couple of pages downstairs in the display case inside the main door. In Bolivia in 1928, a 15-cent stamp was issued with a map showing the Chaco Boliviano extending all the way down to the Paraguay River. A similar map was designed and was used in 1930 for 3 further values printed by Perkins Bacon. They made a local lithograph version of one of these, and then in 1935, a full set of airmail and regular mail definitives were produced by the American Banknote Company, all showing the Chaco as being Bolivia. Paraguay, not to be outdone. 1927, the definitive series had 2 values with a map showing the Chaco region to be Paraguayan. And this was followed in 1932, after the start of the war, with a new map design that showed the Chaco region with an inscription that said the Chaco has been, is, and always will be Paraguayan. Philatelically, there's a lot of work still to be done. On the Bolivian censorship side, for example, new discoveries are still being made. When you think that virtually every small town, village, section of a city, every military camp, every military hospital had censor markings, often locally made, it's a pretty endless list. I don't think we'll ever get 100% completeness. On the Paraguayan side, for example, military cachets alone have recorded well over 100 different, so it's fairly endless. Now, to finish, having joked about the Chaco as a holiday destination, you're going to be pleased to hear this. I can now tell you there's a planned FIP show in Asunción this year, so you can start booking your tickets. Now, this is going to run from the 11th of June to the 15th of June. It's been organized by the Bolivian and Paraguayan Philatelic Associations. This year, of course, marks the 75th anniversary of the outbreak of the Chaco War. And it will be one of the, this is going to be the major theme of the show. A small handful of surviving veterans from both sides, and they are getting old now, older than some of us, have been the invited guests, and the original countries that played a part in the peace treaty of 1938, that's Peru, Chile, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, and the United States, are invited participants with regards to exhibits, etc. So if you ever wanted to visit Paraguay, this could be a good excuse. I'll probably be going. I've been invited to show this collection, and I've also been promised a trip into the Chaco to see some of the wartime sites. In the early part of the war, as I said earlier, it used to be a 2-day journey to get to the front lines. Now you can drive it in 3 hours. So I hope you've enjoyed this brief look at one of the more recent and little-known wars that's affected the Latin American continent. Thank you.
Brian.
thank you very much. Yes, both amusing and yes, we now know a lot more. Some questions?
Andy must want to know something.
Can I?
Yeah, go on.
Can I just ask a simple one, really? If they flew the mail in and out, did they fly men and provisions as well? Was there a route for flying?
They didn't fly many men in. They didn't have any troop carriers or those sorts of planes. Most of the planes were small, tiny planes. You know, they could maybe seat four or five people. They could not fly anything big. In sieges, they used to fly over and try and resupply the places under siege by dropping bullets and that sort of thing. They'd try to drop food and things like that. Invariably, they weren't very good at it, and it generally landed in on the Paraguayan side. The air war was fought quite gallant, you know, with a lot of gallantry. There's a story one time, there weren't any dogfights or not too many, but there's a story one time where one of the Bolivian planes had crashed, and the funeral was going on for the Bolivian pilot, and the Paraguayan plane swooped over and everybody ran for cover, and a huge thorn bush garland was thrown out on top of the grave by the Paraguayan pilot. But, you know, it's one of those little stories that's, you know, probably true.
Probably.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Bruce.
We were talking earlier about censorship, which seemed to me, I mean, any war, and you get this sort of paranoid censorship. Isn't it strange that what are people suspicious about, that everybody let them be censored?
In Bolivia, they were very worried about one thing on overseas mail, and that was people sending money out of the country because of potential devaluation of Bolivian currency. So they were. Censorship also in equal currency control on sending mail overseas. It's very, very difficult. I mean, I don't know what they were looking for in many times. The one cover I had that had a piece of censored mail inside it where they'd actually censored something was somebody was selling a Paraguayan stamp with a map on it of showing the chapel to be Paraguayan. That was censored. Now, how it affected the war effort, I don't know. But I think the Bolivians were paranoid. I mean, there were coups, there were posturing, there were takeover threats at every minute. So, I mean, a lot of the time they were looking for political enemies rather than military enemies, if that's the right way of putting it. You know, the president didn't want to be overthrown, so let's hear about it first.
I've heard this many times, and I didn't they just, you know, worry about disclosure of military secrets or something? For example, one of your letters was written in lemon juice. Why was it so secret about it?
That was a prisoner of war letter where the inside of the envelope was used to convey a secret message. And that's in the frames at the back there. They've written on the inside of the envelope in lemon juice. But that was denouncing one of the other Bolivian prisoners for collaborating with the Paraguayans. It's just interesting on the prisoner of war figures because after the war, they did the repatriations. Now, repatriations didn't actually take part until the war finished in June 1935, but they didn't start sending prisoners back until January 1936. So it was some 6 months later. It's quite interesting of the number of prisoners that were captured, quite a good percentage, almost 10%, ended up staying in their countries where they were prisoners. I mean, they weren't stuck in camps mostly. Because of the manpower shortage in the countries, they were working on the farms, in the fields, doing the, you know, jobs in the cities and things like that while the men were fighting. So, I mean, they were quite happy. They weren't in danger anymore. You know, nobody was shooting at them. So,
They ended up staying in the countries of their captors. So,
Brian, you said that this was only a quarter of your collection. I was wondering why the postmarks on the items shown were so beautiful, almost like philatelically cancelled to order covers. Do you have other covers that are not so well cancelled, or why is it that these, particularly I'm looking at these provisional covers there, they're almost as though they've gone in and done a cancelled to order. Why are they so beautifully cancelled in the middle of the
book? Can I quote you an old advertisement? It's a salmon John West rejects that makes John West salmon the best. this is the choice of the collection. I could equally show you 108 pages of grotty covers. But they're still important because of the markings on them.
Yeah, but why are they, during the war though, why are they so well...
Most covers tend to be, I mean, you'll find some of these are actually quite trimmed down one side or something like that. I mean, they were generally ripped open and things like that. And the vast majority of covers you find are in that sort of condition. These are the cream of the crop.
Thank you.
They've been washed. John, can I ask you to propose a raise of thanks?
Ladies and gentlemen, Chris asked me if I'd give a vote of thanks to Brian. I think on the basis that I went to Iguazu last year, that sort of qualifies me. You've been to South America, you must know something about it. The answer is, I knew nothing. I absolutely knew nothing. And in fact, the only little wars that I knew anything about took place. There were eight of them in Ashanti. There was a hut tax war in Sierra Leone, and Lord Lugard nearly had an outstanding war with the French in northwest Nigeria. He thought they were the real enemy. So, you know, there were a few wars I knew about, but I have to admit, although I'd heard of the Chaco War, I wasn't sure which continent to put it in. Anyway, I also had become not familiar with these sorts of censor marks, but my father was desperately preoccupied with First World War and Second World War censorship. I think mainly because my mother had kept all his letters and postcards and those things that were blown up photographically. He eventually decided that you could make a collection out of censorship. So I knew there was something to do with censorship. But luckily none of the wars I've been involved with had any, as far as I can discover, because most of the people on the other side didn't write letters at all, and they couldn't read. So there I was, faced with, well, what's this about? And all the questions I asked Brian before, he said, well, if you wait a bit, you'll find out. I'm going to talk about it. Well, I have to say that one of the things that I think is terribly important about postal history is that it is genuinely a form of adult education. And its importance is putting it into a social, a geographic, an economic context. You talked about oilless and pointless, but that was the economic context. I asked Brian how a little country like Paraguay really came to exist at all when you've got these enormous areas of Brazil and Argentina, you know, and Chile stretching up and down the west coast. And he said, because nobody really wanted it. The leftovers in the world have been sources of all sorts of conflict and issues. And putting it into shape, I think, is actually something of considerable importance. And if you don't write the book, I hope you'll put some of this into some form that can go in the LP, because I think that would be very valuable. So here we are. We are faced with a sort of hangover from the Spanish. Incidentally, is Paraguay originally Spanish or Portuguese?
That's Spanish.
That's Spanish. They're both Spanish.
You weren't listening. Assumption was the first Spanish capital on the east on the east coast.
So you know, there's what the Spanish left behind and all the problems that went with it.
I also wanted to ask him, but didn't get around to asking him before. He probably wouldn't have answered it anyway. But most of the wars in the 1930s, outsiders involved themselves and tended to make them, because they knew the right answers, much bigger and much more vicious, as they did, obviously, a little bit later, not much later, in Spain. But as far as I can gather from what you were saying, there was only one outsider in this, and he was German, of course. Mm. So the Germans had a hand here, as they did in Spain as well. Anyway, I have found this fascinating. I am always amazed to see stuff that is so difficult, not just in condition, but actually in its real rarity and its unusualness. And when you find mail coming from areas where so few people actually could read or write, certainly on the Bolivian side, it is extraordinary that as much as this can be put together. I know it took 25 years. I've taken 45 trying to do the same thing in another part of the world. It is very hard, and I congratulate you enormously. Thank you for coming and talking to us about it.
To second that, I would like to ask Callum Moorcroft.
Thank you. Brian, I must admit, like John, I didn't know anything about the war before today, but I must thank you for one superb talk, an entertaining talk, but at the end, obviously the tragedy of the war, the futility of it, which unfortunately these pieces of post-history do illustrate. Sad part of it, but what a wonderful story, the way you told it. When I came in this afternoon, Christine said, I said, have you seen the display? And Christine said she had, and she enjoyed it. And the thing she enjoyed very much was your, not just the colours and the stationery and the things, but the little write-ups at the bottom. It puts everything in context. And so when I came up, I looked at that, I thought, yeah, that's great, because like your talk, you can follow through, and everything is in story. Mm. So it's rather nice you've told the story. So I'd like to propose that further thanks to thank you for a wonderful display, a wonderful talk, and a wonderful collection. Thank you very much.
Brian, we give you a memento of this,
ah,
a plaquette.
Thank you.
So you've been here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I think there's a little one over there who probably wants a photograph of
you
as well.
I'd like to have a photograph, please.
And the lady over here that wants a photograph of you. Has she got enough?
Probably. That's excellent. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. No, most excellent. I think we have one other congratulations in here. I gather we have, it's somebody's birthday today, is that right? Somebody at the back?
Keeping quiet.
Happy birthday, Prue.
Yeah.
Oh. Brilliant. We won't ask you to make a speech. Right. We have an invitation for a glass of wine downstairs. Look forward to seeing you there. And thank you for your braving all the elements. I hope by the 1st of March, which is a 3-week gap, which will allow us, as you heard earlier, to we hope to do the staircase properly. First of March, we have a display by the Southeast Region of the Royal, and that's going to be 26 people, 2 frames each, and lots of different things. There's some very fine collections, as we often find, from members that we don't necessarily see up here a lot of the time. So that's a 1 o'clock display in these rooms. And it'll actually be the first time we see the new frames fully in use as well, new stand-up frames. So I hope they work as well as we hope they will.
Of course they will.
With that, thank you, and see you downstairs. Remember.
Yours.
Yeah.
Thank you.